Welcome to another Dragonlance Saga episode. This is a review episode. My name is Adam, and today I'm going to give you my spoiler review for The Lost Chronicles: Dragons of the Dwarven Depths. I will be spoiling this story. If you have not read this book yet, and you do not want to know what happens in it, do not watch this video. Stop watching now and move on about your life. Don't forget to like and subscribe to this channel, ring the bell, and you can support this channel by becoming a patron on Patreon, a member of this YouTube channel, and you can even pick up Dragonlance Gaming materials using my affiliate link. All links are in the description below. And remember, this is my personal perspective only. If you have any thoughts or you disagree with my perspectives, I invite you to share yours in the YouTube chat or in the comments below. All right, so this is the volume one, the very first of a trilogy that was started its release in 2007, I believe. It is called the Lost Chronicles trilogy because it fills in gaps, little holes that were in the original Chronicles trilogy. The reality is, you know, there was, what, like 12 different modules that fleshed out the trilogy and only three novels. And so there's a lot of stuff that was happening in the modules that was never referenced. They just sort of skipped past, or they had Michael Williams write a poem about it. And so ultimately what they did is reached out to Wizards of the Coast in, like, you know, 2002 or something like that, and asked them if they could write this new trilogy. Wizards of the Coast at the time was, I guess, much more friendly towards Dragonlance. And they were like, hell yes, write it and we will get it out there. And so everyone, you know, had the thumbs up. They put out these books. Dragons of the Hourglass Mage had a couple kickbacks, but I'll get into that when it's time to review that one. Anyway, chronologically speaking, I started with Dragons of Autumn Twilight. That was my first review. And now I'm going to Dragons of Dwarven Depths. It gets a little bit more convoluted in the chronology after that between Chronicles and Lost Chronicles. And so I'll do my best to try to break that down as I get into those. But this one was pretty straightforward. It's literally set up exactly at the very, very end of Dragons of Autumn Twilight and moves forward to the beginning of Dragons of Winter Night. Okay, there's the setup. I'm going to read you my review, and on the other side of it, if you have any thoughts or comments or questions or, I don't know, just whatever, throw it in the chat and we'll get to it. It's Friday, everyone. Let's have a great Friday. This is my second reading of Dragons of the Dwarven Depths. My first was when they were originally released, and that was after I had read around 100 Dragonlance novels and played the Dungeons & Dragons and Saga versions of the game. I felt like I knew the trajectory of the Heroes of the Lance, and I was immediately struck by a perceived tonal difference in how the characters spoke, interacted, and projected their sensibilities to the world. Though I enjoyed the story and the spirit of its creation, filling in the gaps of the original Chronicles trilogy, I felt that something was off. This reading that I just finished today, I ended it with a dramatically different take. I had just finished reading the annotated Chronicles Dragons of Autumn Twilight, and right off of that novel, I felt all of my perceptions in my first reading were completely wrong. I judged the characters after having read through their character arcs, and most had died. I read through their children's stories, as the Dragonlance world completely changed a number of times. So my recollection of them in their early careers of adventuring was wrong. I do have to say, though, I know this isn't a children's book, I did miss the chapter heading illustrations that were featured in the Chronicles trilogy. Besides that, I was drawn into not only the meshing of the novel with the original trilogy and the original modules, which were slightly due in part to Verminard's death in Dragons of Autumn Twilight, but not in the modules during the same timeline. The way the authors addressed this potential problem reminded me of how years later, director Mike Flanagan would reconcile the differences between Stanley Kubrick's The Shining film and Stephen King's The Shining and Dr. Sleep novels with his Dr. Sleep film. They turned to creative writing and altered the narrative just enough to pull you deeper into the mythology and world, while tipping their caps at the earlier released sources. The book is broken down into two books, much like Dragons of Autumn Twilight. The first book deals with Draenor and Arrak Draconian, who hatched a scheme with Grag, a Draconian commander, to pose as the Dragon High Lord Verminard, so he could be in a position of power and go after the prisoners of Pax Tharkaz and heroes that rescued them. The refugees, led by the Heroes of the Lance, realize that they're temporarily safe but will soon be trapped in the coming winter and decide to search for the lost kingdom of Thorbarden. Raistlin Majeer is convinced he can find the key to Thorbarden in Skullcap, though he doesn't understand why, and Skullcap is an ancient fortress of Fist and Dantilus's from the Dwarfgate Wars. Tanis Half-Elven and Flint Fireforge believe that they can find it themselves and leave a reluctant Riverwind to act as leader in their stead. The second book focuses on the politics of Thorbarden and the heroes' search for the Hammer of Karas, each having different motivations for its discovery. Sturm Brightblade believes it's essential to create the legendary Dragonlances to be used in the defeat of the Dark Queen's dragon armies like Huma from past ages. The dwarves of Thorbarden want it to unite their people under the mountain, and Draenor wants it to take control of Thorbarden for the Dark Queen. What we are given is a nostalgia-driven tale that leans heavily on foreshadowing and the reader's previous knowledge of the Chronicles trilogy. I don't necessarily think this is a bad thing, but it is a bit ham-fisted for a first-time reader to understand and for a long-time reader to take. Flint Fireforge shines in the second book as the father figure to the heroes. He looked after them in their youth, he fought beside them in their maturity, and now he's truly finding his age. Though in AD&D terms, he's not old for a dwarf. They just set up that his father died of an ailment that Flint himself is beginning to feel early signs of. Again, foreshadowing. We are treated to the reverence of a deity for its children, in the form of Reorks looking to a Nidor, or Hill Dwarf, as the hero to find the Hammer of Karas over the other Mountain Dwarf clans, as they have all forgotten their patron deity, or at least don't actively worship him since the Dwarfgate Wars and the Cataclysm. This is another echo that is seen in every culture in Kryn in this Age of Despair. As a reader, we are all simultaneously cheering for Flint and saddened with the knowledge of his ultimate fate. It is touching to get such deep insights from his inner dialogue, and the connection between him and Tasselhoff Burfoot is strengthened and reinforced for the readers. It struck me as odd that we are introduced to good dragons for the first time, if you're reading this in chronological order as I am now. In that, the good dragons were supposed to be totally absent from Kryn at this moment. Yet, Raistlin, Caramon, and Sturm run across one in its final moments of life in Skullcap in Book 1, and Tasselhoff runs into one that's protecting the Hammer of Karas in Book 2. Though the second dragon's presence was not as jarring as the first, I think this is possibly because the first took the sting out of it. It still seemed like they knew of the Dark Queen's actions, and if they knew, why would they not then get involved? Now, I understand the reason stated. They had their eggs being held hostage by the Dark Queen, but still, it just doesn't feel right as a reader. Either way, the presence of the Red Dragons in Book 1 also felt diminished in use and effect as well. They were treated as spies in the sky and airdrop planes for Draconians. It all felt like a large waste. They reinforced the sense of dragon fear those present feel, even if the dragons cannot be seen, which is one of the wonderful additions to Dragons and Dragonlance that I thought made perfect sense, and added to the power and presence of the magical dragon. It was diminished, however, by those who had felt it before. Again, I understand the rationalization of this. Exposure to anything sensory will eventually be dulled. But what is it, the third or fourth time they were exposed to it? It should still be in full effect, in my opinion. Skullcap was a good bit of fun in Book 1, focusing primarily on Teeka Wailan and Caramon Majeer's relationship, which made sense since it was a relatively poignant part of the first book as far as character development is concerned, but it ended in the only possible place that it could, the expected one. Caramon lives to protect and serve his brother Raistlin. Everything else is secondary. a lesson I thought Tika took away in Dragons of Autumn Twilight, yet is echoed here over and over again in the first book. It ends with Tika's acceptance of the fact, but where else could it have ended? We already know that they're going to get hitched and have kids. What I do want to talk briefly about is the near rape of Tika Waylon by a random draconian who follows her out to Skullcap as she leaves to the dead of night to warn Riverwind of an advancing draconian platoon sent to attack the refugee camp. I felt that this situation was treated as delicately as possible, considering the subject matter. Tika fought off the monster, which ended in its death, but the experience left her scarred and traumatized for a long time. This is not something that should be swept under a rug, even in a fantasy novel, and I feel like they handled it as well as can be expected. It marked a moment of terror and vulnerability that will ultimately lead to a stronger woman despite her assault. Sturman Raceland's relationship is explored and softened a bit as well. I always hated how badly Sturm treated his childhood friend Raceland, simply because he wants to be a Salamnic knight and they distrust magic, and Raceland is a mage. They grew up together! They had shared life experiences together! Life experiences cause you to overlook and move past your bigotry and biases, not reinforce them. But Sturm explained that he looks down on Raceland in part because of how he treats his twin Caramon. And I think we can all understand his position on this. Later in Book 2, Sturm and Raceland agree to convince Flint Firefudge to swap the real Hammer of Karas with a fake one so they can use it in the Great War outside Thorbarden. This is a deeply dishonorable act that Sturm hesitatingly agrees to for the greater good, and is a note to the reader about the greater pragmatic good the Salamnic Knights will eventually adopt over their rigid measures. All in all, I really enjoyed this admittedly flawed return to the Heroes of the Lance and the character development shared. It adds desperately needed world-building time with the Mountain Dwarves and their Kingdom of Thorbarden, and gives us a glimpse into the minds of Draconians for the first time, rather than them being mindless killing monsters. They're conscious creatures with individual motivations and desires. I like my villains fleshed out. Sometimes even more than I like my heroes fleshed out. It's one of the reasons I love the Star Wars prequel trilogy and the Clone Wars cartoon. They help flesh out the best fictional villain story of all time, the tragedy of Anakin Skywalker and his fall to Darth Vader. Now, I highly recommend this novel to any Dragonlance fan, but if you aren't a Heroes of the Lance junkie, you could probably skip it. And that is my review of Dragons of the Dwarven Depths. This is book one in the Lost Chronicles trilogy. What did you guys think? Have you read this yet? Did I just spoil it for you because you jumped in the feed, the live stream halfway through and missed the spoiler reference? Was there any insight that you gained while you were reading it yourself, or perhaps when you read someone else's review, or perhaps listened to mine? I think what's really great about really any novel, but Dragonlance specifically because this is the channel, is that when you revisit these stories at different periods in your life, you reflect differently on the events, characters, and interactions in these books. And when you listen to other people's reviews or you read their reviews, you see their insights and you can sort of bounce new ideas off of each other. And I think that's really kind of a cool experience to be a part of, which is why I always welcome you guys to share your thoughts. And if I'm live, then of course live in chat. And if I'm not, then in the comments. Because ultimately, understanding how others perceive these stories adds added insight for myself. So maybe it's a selfish thing. I don't know. Well, that's really all I had. I didn't go into massive plot details, though I hit some really, you know, pretty heavy ones there early on. I'm a little bit bummed whenever I see the great artwork, like this Lost Legends trilogy cover artwork was created by Matt Stawicki, and he is really, really talented. But this particular cover is a little misleading because it shows Goldmoon in the background, and she's really not in book two at all, you know, and she's barely even in book one. She's used as a sort of moral compass for Riverwind more than an individual character herself. And, you know, she'll get her own books to shine in and storylines to shine in later on in the saga. But, you know, at the very beginning, not so bad. All right, Winston, thank you so much for joining live. Great to see you. You enjoyed the story at face value and then filling in between On Twilight and Winter Night. Yeah. Yeah. And really, that's what it is. You know, this is like a really nice, it's like a peanut butter filling. You know what I mean? It's if you like peanut butter, if you're a Reese's person, you know, you have this wonderful chocolate on either side. And this is perfect peanut butter filling for the middle of two really great books. You can kind of overdo it with the filling, or it can just be just enough for you. And I think that, you know, depends on the individual. What I really think the strength of this novel was diving into the atmosphere and terrain and complexity and politics of Thorbjarn. I enjoyed that much more than I enjoyed the machinations of the Draconians or the refugees and the heroes trying to find a place for them. I thought Skullcap was a really great location, which I would have loved to have explored more. But I feel like we get so much Fist and Dantalus in the Legends trilogy, and he has his own book, that I don't know if we needed it in this at all. It also felt like they kind of sped past the final, sort of battle, I guess it was, between the different clans of the dwarves at the very end with the Draconians. It just felt super rushed, and the resolution was, it just felt like, you know, they got to a point where they're like, okay, well, we can't make this into two books, so let's hurry up and, you know, put a bow on this so we can move past it, knowing that there's not going to be a direct sequel to this. The next book in the Lost Chronicles is going to happen at the middle point of Dragons of Winter Night. So, you know, I did feel like they rushed the ending a little bit, and it wasn't as satisfying as I want it to be. However, and let me put a pin in this, what Flint did at the very end, I thought was so powerful, because the entire time he is being singled out by Reorks the God himself as being the hero. He's being pitted against another one of the dwarves who believes he should be the hero, but Flint, you know, he always fantasized about being a hero, but he never saw himself as one, even though everything that he's done in his life has proven that he's a hero. He's looked after kids in his village. He took in an orphan as a business partner in Tanis. Like, he took a bunch of kids under his wing and protected them. Like, if that's not heroic, I don't know what is. Like, he is the pure definition of a hero. And the truth is he knows he loves Tasselhoff, even though Tasselhoff drives him mad all the time. I mean, he's just the greatest of characters, and to see him in his, you know, declining years as we enter this story, and he's filled with self-doubt, and he's filled with second-guessing his actions and motivations. He doesn't feel like he should have tricked his dwarven brothers, even though they're completely different clans and his was shunned by the mountain dwarves. It's still at the end. He decides to give all of the honor, all of the respect to one of the mountain clans, the Hylar clan's son, the clan leader's son. And honestly, ended up making him the hero, which only then bolsters the fact that Flint is a real hero, which I just thought was so beautiful. But the fact that he gives up the Hammer of Karas just so that the father of this fallen man can see that his son is the hero that he always wanted to be and not this sort of crazy kid that everyone thought he was, that really moved me. Like, that was a beautiful thing to do. It was selfless, and I wouldn't have done it as a human being. No way. I'm much too selfish for stuff like that. But I can recognize and appreciate the beauty in others doing it. That ending after Rayan, the Draconian, was killed, and Flint's actions, and the fact that after he did it, he felt responsible for the kid's death because he had switched the hammers. Like, he felt guilty the whole time just because one person died that he was with. I mean, that's just a good person. You know, that's Flint Fireforge is the man. I love that character. And it just compounds the fact of how devastating it is because we know what's going to happen to him, you know? And, you know, ultimately, you know, death meets us all. It's in the mail for every one of us. And it's random, and, you know, we know it's coming, but we choose to focus on the bright side of life rather than dwelling on the darkness. But we still know it's coming. And this story really heightened Flint's clock for me. Kind of made me sad for him. Anyway, I guess that's enough. Thank you guys so much. I appreciate your time and attention. And, you know, you're always welcome to support this channel in any way you like. You know, again, you can use the affiliate link in the descriptions. If you want to become a member of the YouTube channel, then you actually get a little Dragon High Lord icon right next to your name when you chat with me in the live chat. And you can get access to emojis in the live chat as well. Right now I have a few Heroes of the Lance on there. And I'll be adding more as more people sign in. It's sort of got a limit that way. They unlock more slots the more people you have as members. And then I'm also on Patreon if you want to support, or if you're able to support that way too. I always appreciate it. I'm trying to release 3 videos a week. And then if I have something to say or if I have thoughts or anything, I'm going to add in more. But always Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday is when you can expect a video from me of some sort. Right now they're set up as setting videos on Tuesday, mail videos on Wednesday, and reading videos on Thursday. And that's going to do it. Thank you so much. Have a fantastic Friday, everyone. Go do something fun. Get outside. It's regionally, it might be miserable weather, but if you get out in nature, you always feel better doing it. Always. Even if it's raining on you. And well, as they used to say in the service, if it ain't raining, you ain't training. That's it. Have a wonderful day. Till next time. Slán Javar.